This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to talk about a new book just out that details the history of perhaps one of the most important moments in the 20th century that continues into the 21st century. We're going to talk with the author of the book. Steve Olson joins us from Washington State. Is it Seattle, Steve?
It is. I do live in Seattle now, though I used to live in the eastern part of the state.
Steve Olson is the author of the brand new book, The Apocalypse Factory, Plutonium and the Making of the Atomic Age. It is fascinating to read, Steve. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you write the book?
A variety of reasons, but I probably wouldn't have written the book if I didn't grow up in eastern Washington. I grew up in a little town called Othello, which is about 2 hours south of Spokane, and it's just 15 miles away from the nearest reactor at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, we knew about Hanford, but didn't know a lot about it, and I've been curious about it ever since I was a kid.
Well, you mentioned that Hanford nuclear facility. I didn't realize how large it was until you described it in your book. Give our listeners a sense of the scale of this facility.
Well, goodness, what, 600 square miles, half the size of Rhode Island? It's an immense facility, but a lot of the land was really left untouched. In fact, they've made a lot of it into a wildlife refuge now or into a national monument because it really preserves some of the original prairie-type conditions that were there before the 1940s, because relatively little of the land has been used. Now, the land that has been used at Hanford has been used hard to build nuclear reactors and chemical processing plants. And that cleanup, of course, is still ongoing today.
Give our listeners again a sense of why this facility ended up at Hanford and what had to be done to get it ready.
Yeah, it's all associated with the early years of World War II and with what was going on in scientific labs, amazingly enough. One of the things I was astonished to discover when I started doing research for this book was that plutonium, which is why Hanford was established. Hanford was set up to make plutonium for use in atomic weapons, first during World War II and subsequently all the nuclear weapons that are in the U.S. arsenal today. Hanford's entire reason for existence is to make plutonium. And plutonium was only discovered in 1941 by a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, named Glenn Seaborg. And if he hadn't discovered plutonium at just that time, just really a few months before Pearl Harbor, it's quite likely the Manhattan Project never would have happened. The discovery of plutonium gave scientists two ways to make an atomic bomb. They could use a very rare isotope of uranium called uranium-235, which was produced at the Oak Ridge facility in Tennessee. But they could also use plutonium, and plutonium, pound for pound, generates a more powerful explosion than uranium. And so that's one of the reasons why Hanford remained so important to the U.S. nuclear weapons program, really all the way through the Cold War.
The book, The Apocalypse Factory, has four parts to it. It's the road to Hanford, that is the science behind the atomic bomb, the urgency during World War II to develop that weapon before they thought the Nazis were going to develop it. It turned out that the Nazis weren't quite as far along as we had feared. Then the second part is a factory in the desert, this immense factory called Hanford, and the secrecy around it. Then the third part is Under the Mushroom Cloud, and this is almost an homage to John Hersey, and you dedicate a piece of the book, the memory of John Hersey, right in the front of the book, because you're talking about the effects of the actual bomb on Nagasaki. He wrote about Hiroshima, but you talk about the effects and the decision to drop the bomb on Nagasaki. And then the last part of the book is Confronting Armageddon, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the contamination that results from processing these very dangerous substances. It's a fascinating book. It tells the story in context and the way we're still living with a decision that was made, well, almost 80 years ago.
Exactly. Yes. It's interesting you would mention John Hersey. I took a course from him. He's sort of my connection to World War II. I took a course from him in college on book writing. It was one of the reasons I was a science major in college, interested in physics, and there's lots of science in this book. But when I was a senior, I took a course from John Hersey about writing, and we studied Hiroshima and some of his other books and talked about the ways that he constructs his books. And really, all the books that I've written have had his influence in them. And I thought that this would be an appropriate one to mention my debt to him as an instructor.
Well, I'd certainly heard about Robert Oppenheimer and Enrico Fermi and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president who authorized the development of this weapon, and Harry Truman, the president who authorized dropping it on Japan. I had not heard of Glenn Seaborg before, and I wish I had. He's very important.
Oh, very important to this story. Yes, critically important, and really has been sort of criminally neglected in many histories of the Manhattan Project and the whole nuclear age, because he was important both during World War II and before World War II as the discoverer of plutonium, but also played a prominent role after World War II. He was one of the heads of the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy and Johnson, and played an important role in promoting a nuclear power in the 1950s and 1960s. Also worked hard to establish some of the treaty that tried to rein in the weapons that his discovery had led to.
Do you think he ever regretted this letting the genie out of the bottle as he did? I assume somebody would have discovered plutonium anyway, but he's the guy who kind of did.
He said he didn't regret it. He said that if the world was constructed in such a way that atomic bombs could be made, he was glad that the United States had discovered that first and not Germany. He also said that he wished the world were constructed in such a way that atomic bombs were not possible. And it is the case that when you look at this from a physics perspective, it's just to our misfortune that a few of these elements can be put together in such a way as to produce nuclear explosions, because if just a few slight tweaks in the world were different, that wouldn't be possible.
Steve Olson is the author of The Apocalypse Factory. And Steve, you say you're a science writer, and that I really appreciated, because as I was reading the book, I was struck with the clarity. I finally kind of understood how this whole thing worked, and the simplicity, frankly, physics around it are pretty complicated, but the simplicity of that pile that they built under the football stadium at the University of Chicago in the early 40s, a nuclear reactor is, in a sense, a pretty simple device.
It's incredibly simple. I mean, I actually did not appreciate it until I started writing this book myself and started trying to describe how the science of a nuclear reactor works. And you know, that section of the book used to be a lot longer, and my editor at W.W. Norton, which is the publisher of my book, said, well, that's kind of a lot of science to wade through before they even start building Hanford. So I worked hard to try to hone that science down. But, you know, the process of what happens inside a nuclear reactor is just astonishing that it would work, and it is relatively simple. You take uranium ore, and you put it in a big structure of graphite, and the uranium ore starts converting some of those uranium atoms into plutonium. And that's the essential process. That's what Hanford was built to do. There were 9 nuclear reactors there eventually, and those 9 reactors were engaged in this process of converting uranium atoms into plutonium atoms. Then you take that uranium ore back out of the reactor, and you send it to these massive chemical cross-processing plants at Hanford. To extract the plutonium out of those irradiated fuel rods. And it's that pure plutonium that you use to make atomic weapons.
I was also quite impressed by the fact that all these many years ago, before World War II and during World War II, these physicists were using their creative imaginations and very high level of math to predict something that hadn't happened before.
Well, predict something and build something.
Yes.
When you go see this, the very first large-scale reactor that was ever built in the world, and all reactors since then are descended from this one reactor. It's part of the Manhattan Project National Historical Park. And you can go to Hanford and tour that reactor. And it really has not changed since Enrico Fermi was there in 1944 and started that reactor up. And the calculations and the work that went into that reactor, all kinds of new technologies were developed just in a matter of months to be able to make a nuclear reactor work. Enrico Fermi had built one at the University of Chicago, but it was very small scale. And the one that was the first one constructed at Hanford was much, much larger, cooled by water, really thousands of times larger than the first pile, you know, the first nuclear reactor that he built in Chicago. And so when you walk in and see the face of that reactor, it's just astonishing that the thing actually did work and actually did make plutonium. There were so many things that could have gone wrong.
Well, it was located where it was, at Hanford, Washington, because it was of its adjacency to the Columbia River. They needed that massive river full of cold water to keep the thing cool. Give our listeners a sense of how big one of these buildings was and or is, and how many of them they built.
During the Manhattan Project, three reactors were built altogether. The first one was the B reactor, then there was the D reactor, and the F reactor. The F reactor is the one that was just 15 miles away from where I grew up. They are immense facilities. It really takes your breath away when you walk into the and see the face of reactor, which is about 2,000 aluminum tubes, and you would put these fuel rods about the size of like a paper towel roll, you know, something like that, into these tubes, and the uranium would start interacting with each other inside of the reactors and converting. It would both generate neutrons through chain reactions, and then those neutrons would convert the uranium atoms into plutonium, which was the object of Hanford. I mean, as large as the reactors were, the chemical separating plants, which there are five of them at Hanford, they're even bigger. The workers who built them in the 1940s and 1950s, including my grandfather, by the way, who was a steam fitter at Hanford, used to call them Queen Marys because they're as big as ocean liners. They're just these big windowless concrete rectangles in the desert. They're an amazing thing to see in the middle of something where there's just nothing else for miles around.
The other thing your book tells the story of, and this is the Apocalypse Factory, we're talking with author Steve Olson about this, is that Lieutenant General Leslie Groves was the guy who was in charge of the Army Corps of Engineers construction project that put all these things together. And at one point, there were tens of thousands of people living and working at this site in eastern Washington.
Yes, Groves was the head of the Manhattan Project. So he was running not only Hanford, but the facilities at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that were making the uranium, which was used in the Hiroshima bomb, and also the Los Alamos Laboratory, where all physicists from all over the world and country came together to design and construct bombs using the materials that were being produced at Oak Ridge and at Hanford.
And of course, you've referenced this before, but there were two bombs dropped. The one on Hiroshima was U-235, and that was 100 and some pounds at the core. The one dropped on Nagasaki a few days later was plutonium, and that was like a tenth of the weight of the thing the core was of the bomb that dropped on Hiroshima. So it's interesting how quickly this scientific development to create something really dangerous moved. We're thinking about just a few years. World War II didn't last that long. We've fought many longer wars since, to less resolution, I might add. But the buildup in this country to get these things built and to create the great war machine that in some ways still persists was remarkable.
And a lot of these critical decisions were made in just weeks and days at the very end of the war. Even when the Hiroshima bomb was dropped, people knew that bombs like that would not be made in the future. The Hiroshima bomb was sort of a technological one-off. It's a very inefficient and very dangerous bomb because transporting it can easily set off the bomb. So the Nagasaki bomb, even at that time, people realized that was the future of nuclear weapons. You were going to have much, much smaller quantities of this more powerful material of plutonium. You could generate plutonium much faster at the Hanford plant than they could make uranium, the rare isotope of uranium at the Oak Ridge plant. And so that's why all of our nuclear weapons today, including all those in the missile silos of the Midwest, are really built around a Nagasaki-type bomb, which generates the temperatures and the heat that then starts fusion reactions going in the hydrogen elements and isotopes that surround the bomb.
Well, give us a sense of the scale. We know how big those bombs were that dropped on the two Japanese cities. How would they compare to a hydrogen bomb now?
Yeah, there's astonishing things about scale. I mean, one amazing thing about the scale is that the amount of plutonium inside the Nagasaki bomb was about the size of your fist, or about the size of an apple. And the way that you generated the explosion was by squeezing that plutonium down to about half its volume. So it's like squeezing a snowball down. So it's just an incredibly tiny amount of plutonium can generate this immense devastation and human carnage. I spent a week while writing the book and writing that section of the book in Nagasaki and retracing the steps of a surgeon at the Nagasaki University Medical Hospital and what happened to him in the right after the explosion. He was about a half mile away from the hypocenter of where the point on the ground where the atomic bomb exploded. He was in a hospital that had thick reinforced concrete walls, which is why he survived and why he didn't absorb so much radiation that he succumbed to radiation poisoning. And then I spent also time while I was in Nagasaki just seeing what this bomb did to the rest of the city, the incredible devastation that those bombs caused. And those bombs are very small by today's standards. The weapons that are in the nuclear weapons that we have and that the Russians have that are aimed at us and that other nations have are tens and in some cases hundreds of times bigger than the ones dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. A single bomb would really completely devastate a good-sized American city.
That Japanese surgeon that you write about lost both of his sons to the bomb and acted heroically in the aftermath, helping to save whatever lives he could and discovering that there was a sickness that came with this device that hadn't really been seen before. Let's talk about the decision to drop the bomb. First of all, that there was a test, the Trinity test at Los Alamos, to prove in front of everybody that it would work, and then the decision to actually drop it on people, because that was a troubling decision.
Yes, there were many things going on at the end of the war that contributed to that decision. There was a lot of momentum that had been established that led to the dropping of not just one bomb, but two bombs. After all, the Nagasaki bomb was dropped just 3 days after the Hiroshima bomb. What criticism was that the United States did not give Japan enough time to react to the Hiroshima bomb before dropping a second bomb. Although after the Hiroshima bomb, the Japanese government did not surrender. And General Groves, who led the program, always felt that two bombs would be necessary to demonstrate to the Japanese that the United States could keep making atomic bombs, as many bombs as were needed to force the Japanese to surrender. You know, we often look back at that historical decision and cast it in relatively simple terms. People will say things like, oh, President Truman was making a choice between that or the invasion of Japan. And this was a narrative that was sort of constructed after the war, in part to justify the decision to use atomic weapons when it became clear how horrific their effects had been. But there were, when you look at historically at the many things that were happening at the time, many different factors went into that decision.
And yes,
the Truman never really faced that kind of stark decision in his decision to use the bomb. General Groves was convinced that the bomb should be used. We had been firebombing Japanese cities incessantly since the beginning of March. In some ways, the use of the atomic weapons was just a continuation of the firebombing campaign that had already been started and carried out with conventional explosives.
And one of the reasons they picked those two cities was because they had been relatively unscathed by previous bombing missions, and they wanted to see what the full effect of an atomic weapon would be.
Exactly. Yeah, they had really designated those cities, and they had pleaded with the Air Force not to bomb those cities because they wanted those cities to be relatively unscarred, both to see what the effects of the atomic bomb could be and also to demonstrate to the Japanese people how devastating these bombs were. Feeling that the psychological shock that the bombs would impose on the Japanese people would make them more willing to accept the terms of the surrender that the United States was demanding.
And you also remind us historically that the Soviet Union was about to enter the war against Japan, that they'd made that agreement previously, and it was only a few weeks away, or actually a few, probably even less than that, when the bombs were dropped, and one of those was sort of a political decision. Well, we don't want the Soviet Union to be too strong at this point in the decision about how to deal with Japan after the war.
Yeah, all these things were happening at the same time. You're exactly right. The Hiroshima bomb was dropped. The Soviets invaded China and Japan from the northwest. That was sort of the last hope that the Japanese had, that they could somehow use the Soviets as an intermediary to end the war on better terms for themselves when the Soviet Union invaded. they realized that that was not going to happen. And then the second bomb fell on Nagasaki. It was the combination of events that finally swayed the Japanese government, which before then had been more or less evenly decided about continuing the war, ending the war, to accept the surrender terms.
I grew up in the nuclear age. I grew up in grade school doing the duck, tuck, and cover thing, which, frankly, if a nuclear weapon had been dropped anywhere near our grade school, even a mile or two or three away, chances are we wouldn't have survived. But it was a reminder of how dangerous things were post-World War II because of nuclear proliferation. The United States and the Soviet Union were in an arms race, and in a certain way still are.
And, oh, absolutely.
And the weapons that both countries possess and other countries possess now too, North Korea among them, are remarkably powerful weapons.
Well, you have quite a bit of Hanford's plutonium out there in the nuclear weapons that are in missile silos in the Midwest. As do I. From here in Seattle, I look toward the Olympic Mountains, and about halfway between me and the mountains, so 20 miles northwest of Seattle, is the largest stockpile of deployed nuclear weapons anywhere in the United States. That's the submarine base, the West Coast submarine base for the Navy. Our nuclear submarines sail out of there, and there are about 1,000 nuclear weapons that are deployed on those submarines and stored at that base. So both the Midwest, where you are, and the Seattle area where I am, we would be prime targets, and undoubtedly are prime targets, for the weapons that Russia has aimed at us in the same way that our weapons are aimed at them.
Along with the weapons, there was also the promise of nuclear power. The nuclear energy would power the world. There was a nuclear reactor built in Elk River, Minnesota. It was the first such plant to supply power to a rural electric co-op. It started supplying power in 1964. It was shut down just 4 years later because there was a chronic leakage of contaminated water from that reactor vessel, which brings us to the aftermath of all of this. There's a lot of cleanup to do at Hanford, among other places.
Exactly. The immense amount of cleanup. I mean, it's just an environmental disaster or a catastrophe. Well, it's sort of a catastrophe in the making at Hanford. There are these tanks, stainless steel tanks at the Hanford site, which are filled with the chemicals and the radioisotopes that were generated by making all this plutonium. And those tanks still contain the chemicals that were used way back in World War II, more than 75 years ago, to produce the plutonium for the Trinity test and for the Nagasaki bomb. The chemicals really have stayed in those tanks ever since. If those tanks start to leak, and some of them already are, but if, for instance, there was an earthquake and the leakage rates really expanded, it could be an environmental disaster if those chemicals were released into the soil and started flowing toward the Columbia River and then downriver toward the million or several million people actually that rely upon that water. The Department of Energy, you know, has made a fair amount of progress in cleaning up the Hanford site, but there's still a long ways to go. It's still going to take decades and hundreds of billions of dollars to deal with the rest of the contaminants that are there, and especially those radiological chemicals that are sitting in those tanks.
And as we've been reminded, we were reminded right after World War II when the Soviets started dropping nuclear weapons and testing them, and we grew up with the strontium-90 scare in where I was a kid, about fallout from nuclear weapons testing, contaminating milk, and perhaps endangering our lives. We also have that other issue out there. We've got terrorists. We've got what is a technology that's now, you know, 75 years old, that we are still living under the threat of atomic attack.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. We worry all the time about climate change creating an uninhabitable world and posing an existential threat to human beings. But the human civilization could end in the next 24 hours if these weapons were used either as a result of war or as a result of a mistake. It's not just the fact that these weapons are sitting there and possibly could be commandeered by terrorists. They also run on very old computer systems. And there are hackers out there in the world who know how to get into those computer systems. And people in high positions of government worry quite a bit about hackers getting into nuclear control systems and creating signals that, for instance, make it look like an attack is underway, in which case the United States would face the decision of whether or not to launch its weapons before those weapons could be destroyed by an incoming attack. I mean, the whole system is still on a ridiculous and sort of insane hair trigger.
Steve Olson is the author of the brand new book, The Apocalypse Factory, Plutonium and the Making of the Atomic Age. It is a provocative read. I recommend it. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it was really fun.
Coming up, the FM Community Theater is putting on Hairspray, pandemically aware as they do it. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum says if people receiving unemployment are worried about paying the rent, if they lose the added $600 federal unemployment benefit, the state still has a program in place to help. The Rent Bridge program helps pay for rent.
Since it was launched, Emergency Rent Bridge has helped over 300 separate renters in 15 counties stay current on their rent.
Burgum says that program is part of a strategy of housing first.
Because once they become homeless, we know that the demand for other services also goes up, food, nutrition, healthcare, mental health, and other services. And so this is a way to actually save money relative to other services. And so, again, we want to help people get through this time frame.
Information on the program is on the State Human Services Department website or on ndresponse.nd.gov. That's ndresponse.nd.gov. Minnesota 7th District Congressman Colin Peterson says Minnesota's statewide COVID-19 restrictions imposed by Governor Tim Walz are harming the rural economy. Peterson says some western Minnesota businesses are losing money because the state's mandates differ from less restrictive guidelines in the Dakotas. He says the situation is creating a lot of hardships.
I've had a number of discussions with the governor about this where, you know, because we're against North and South Dakota, we got problems with people losing business across the border to states that have different criteria than we do. It's very hard to explain to them why they should be shut down when it's other, you know, it's Minneapolis and St. Cloud and the areas that's really having the problem.
In addition to a statewide mask mandate, Minnesota bars, restaurants, and retail businesses are limited to 50% capacity. Entertainment, events, and places of worship are restricted to 250 people or less, and there are no statewide mask mandates in North Dakota or South Dakota. And the North Dakota Farmers Union will be building a new youth camp on the shore of the Jamestown Reservoir. The Farmers Union owns a camp on Lake Scheida near Glen Ullin.
We've been renting different locations throughout the state in order to have a location that's available for every kid to attend in the state.
Bree Sorensen is the Farmers Union Education Director.
This opportunity came up and we jumped on it just because owning our own facility, we can control camp dates and have a better opportunity for the kids to go to camp throughout the summer.
Sorensen says in a normal year, around 1,200 kids attend Farmers Union Camp. Sessions run from June to August. She says this camp will be more centrally located.
It makes sense. Getting kids here, it's easy.
Ann Sorensen expects this will attract even more kids to camp. The plan is to have the new camp ready for next summer. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
So much in our world has become uncertain.
That's why we make it our business to bring you the news in the way that you expect it.
We make All Things Considered.
We make Morning Edition.
We make NPR.
For you.
For you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Adam Panko. He's the artistic director for the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater and the director of Hairspray, which is now playing at the Lights at Cheyenne, which is south of West Fargo's Cheyenne Street, their main drag there. Brand new development and an outdoor plaza, which is important, right, Adam?
It's absolutely important. I would say it's key to us even having this opportunity available this summer.
Because, of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic, and this is, I guess, the first sort of stage show you've had in a while, isn't it?
Yeah, we canceled everything starting in March. We were in the middle of a run of a show, Flanagan's Wake, and we canceled half of that about the 15th of March, and we've been pretty silent ever since. So it feels good to be back on stage, but of course it's tons different to make it happen.
Well, before you came to the community theater, you were directing theater at West Fargo High School, and you directed this show, Hairspray. It's a big musical, back in 2011. Why did you want to do it again?
Well, first of all, it's just a great piece of musical theater. There's really great opportunities for lots of different people to be involved. And we saw this as an opportunity for us to kind of hit our target market in the summer, which is high school and college kids. And so these are all very age-appropriate roles and allow for us to bring in a lot of different people to make this happen. So it seemed when we picked the show last summer, honestly, and announced it in the fall, it just seemed like a great challenge for our organization to take on. And certainly it's taken on new meaning in the time since then.
Well, it is set in 1962 in Baltimore, Maryland, and that's a very diverse city. And of course, this was before the Civil Rights Act was enacted, so things were a little turbulent then. Given the increased diversity of Fargo-Moorhead, was casting less of a challenge?
Yeah, it was less of a challenge. I actually, you know, when I did it at West Fargo High in 2011, it was a little bit more of a challenge, even though we had a diverse population, particularly with new Americans in our school, and we were able to engage with that population, which was really rewarding to do. But for this show, with its requirements of ensemble of African Americans, it was a lot easier. It did attract individuals that might not have come out to audition for things, knowing that there specifically were roles written for them and their background and their perspective. And so that has been another really rewarding piece of doing this. And then you add on to that the conversation that we're having nationally as a country right now about race and all of that. And so we were really able to learn from each other, this group of individuals that we had on our stage, and we were able to really kind of pick apart some of the things that are similar about this fight in 1962 in Baltimore and how in a lot of ways it's a similar fight in 2020.
So you were talking with the cast and crew. There was discussion during the rehearsal process about what this show dealt with.
Absolutely. I mean, it would have been pretty irresponsible for me to not talk about that. Although it's interesting, you know, a conversation about race, I don't know why it's so taboo, and I'm a white man. And so I came in with a little trepidation, even though I knew exactly what I wanted to talk about. I knew exactly how I wanted to talk about it, but for some reason it seemed taboo for me to even broach the subject with our persons of color. And I recognize that as a failing of myself and others like me as well. I don't know why I was so nervous about it, but the room really opened up and it became a conversation and lots of people had questions and things to say. And it was actually a really beautiful dialogue among our people of color in the cast and the rest of our cast, which is predominantly white.
Was it enlightening? Was it informative? Or was it just a good way to kind of break the ice and talk about something that's really important in a deep way?
You know, it was both of those things. Honestly, there were perspectives that were shared that I hadn't even considered. And I'm a 40 years old, you know, at this point, and I'm in a circle with teenagers and early 20 somethings, and their perspectives, particularly what it was like for a lot of them to live in our people of color, to live in their skin. And they talked a lot about that. Like it's different to go to a grocery store, or it's a knock on the door in the middle of the night means something different. Particularly in this case, in talking about the police as a part of that. And so we had a conversation about that. We had a conversation about, you know, just kind of random kind of stop and checks along the way, which is something that I didn't really think was an issue, certainly in our Fargo-Moorhead community. But it turns out that it is. And so those perspectives were really interesting to learn that. And talking about some of the discrimination and some of the roadblocks that people of color in our community face in even in just very subtle ways really was eye-opening for me as a 40-year-old white man.
Well, I'm a 70-year-old white man, and I can remember quite vividly the civil rights disruptions during the 60s, and they left a deep impression on me, and I've actually, when I think back on it then and now, I understand, I think, white privilege, because I didn't have to deal with this day-to-day existence and standing out because of my complexion that so many other people have to deal with. But I can tell you that the march across the bridge in Selma, Alabama, where John Lewis was injured, was deeply affecting to not just me, but to lots of people my age.
Sure.
And I had the added benefit of having a mother who was from Northwest Tennessee, where there was still segregation practiced back in the 60s. So I got to see some of that that my friends, my contemporaries at the time in Minnesota, did not get to see. And I have to say, I have never forgotten it. I wrestle with it still. I wonder how we ever got to this point, not having resolved these issues. It, frankly, I thought with the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and 65, the Voting Act, that all of this would be history someday.
60 years later, why we're still talking about some of these really base level, you know, civil liberties and messages of equality. It is mind-boggling, isn't it, that it is still something that is prevalent, that is still something that we have a lot of work to do as a society. And so that has been really an eye-opening piece of this summer for me, an unintended piece when we chose this show back last fall. Obviously, that conversation in our country has rightfully ramped up again. And although we would have talked about race, still, even had the events of the last few months not happen, we're certainly talking about it in a much different way, in a much deeper way right now. And I think for all of us sitting in that circle and having that conversation together, I think we've all been enlightened in some way. And even those that might be moved in just the smallest of ways, that still seems like progress.
Well, Hairspray has this theme interwoven with it, but it is, of course, a musical comedy that's a lot of fun, a lot of dancing, a lot of stuff. So how do you stage it in a time of pandemic?
Well, that is the million-dollar question with it all. And we certainly had a lot of discussions, too, with our cast and crew, even deciding to move forward with this and said, okay, what sort of things would be appropriate to do to make a rehearsal environment still creative, but obviously very safe. And so we set up, kind of established our own protocols going into this rehearsal, the cast and crew and myself, and certainly us as an organization. We talked about the things that we needed to do. And so it's the things that anybody should be doing to stay safe right now is masks and a lot of sanitizers and distancing. But yet that is tricky when you are staging a piece of theater, not just a musical, to ensure that we have that all of the time. So I would say another big piece of us being able to do this successfully and keep those around us safe is honestly in putting a lot of trust into our community of artists that we have there. Honestly, we rehearse this thing from about 8:30 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. And so we're spending, you know, the chunk of our day together. And so for our cast and crew, that mostly meant like our quarantining circle, our individuals that were closest to us we were with them 9 hours, and then the rest of the time was away and not doing things that would put others at risk. So I acknowledge, you know, and the cast acknowledges too. I mean, that's a heavy list, and there's no 100% certainties in that kind of model. But for us, we did have a cast and crew that was really passionate about trying to make this happen and keeping each other safe. And so at the end of it all, I do think that was kind of our biggest piece of assurance that we could have in making it happen. But again, there were no guarantees, but we're awfully thankful that we were able to make this happen for everybody in a safe way.
Adam Pankow is the artistic director of the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater, and he's directing Hairspray, which is performing this evening through Friday, 7:30 p.m. is the, I guess, the lights come on at the lights at Cheyenne, which is at 3100 Cheyenne Street in West Fargo. Tickets are $15 to $25 for reserve seats, $10 to $15 for bring your own chair, because it's that kind of venue. It's a big outdoor plaza. Adam, are you saying that everybody's sort of agreed to self-quarantine through the course of the rehearsal and the performance?
Yes, that is true. That was kind of part of our arrangement that we had set up as a cast and the trust that we kind of put in each other. So, I mean, we're still doing things like, you know, going out to the grocery store and you know, filling our cars with gas. And so obviously there's a risk, you know, with that as well. But For right or wrong, that's how we approach things, and we have been holding each other, lifting each other up, and keeping each other safe.
This outdoor venue allows you some space, I guess, for the cast as well. Are you doing some social distancing? I mean, there's a lot of dancing in Hairspray. How do you do that?
Yes. Well, you know, thankfully, you know, the dance styles of the 1960s are pretty isolated when you think of things like the twist and the pony and
the frug, all of that stuff.
All of that is pretty, you know, it's not coupled dancing. It's spaced out. And so that's given us some allowances, certainly on stage, to do that. I would say our staging is a little more spread out than you would normally see. And so that has helped that as well. We are performing without masks. That is a choice that we came to together. But the second that we go off stage, those masks are back on. And so when we are off stage, when it does get a little tighter quarters, certainly than on our stage, our masks are on and our distancing is much more respected, certainly because we have more people that we've added into our circle as of late with our crew that's working the show backstage as well.
Well, what is the total number of cast and crew?
So we have 32 in our cast.
Wow.
And then we have there are probably another 5 individuals that are backstage working with our cast.
And how is the music handled?
Normally, we'd have live musicians in playing our score. We opted instead for pre-recorded tracks. And so that eliminates, you know, another level of potential harm with those players blowing into their instruments and adding to that mix. So we're doing pre-recorded tracks this summer.
Now, you've opened this show last Saturday. How would you gauge the response, and what kind of a crowd did you draw?
The response this weekend was really fantastic. I think even myself was surprised at actually how cathartic it felt to have this live theater experience happen. And many of the patrons that saw the show just went, oh my gosh, I hadn't realized how much I had missed this sort of experience. Again, it's different, but entertainment has been our lifeline these last few months. And so the chance to see entertainment in a live and local way, in an outdoor setting, in a distance setting, I think is a real nice step.
One real complication for any show, and particularly a large cast show and a musical, is what if somebody gets sick? And usually the process in a show as well, you just push through. Somebody, you don't typically not show up to do the show, and sometimes you're double cast for major roles and that kind of thing. But did you have a contingency plan if a cast member or somebody tested positive or became ill?
Yes, we certainly did. And honestly, that contingency plan was pretty much just pulling the plug on it.
Yeah.
This program that we run with our high school and college students has typically about a 3.5-week rehearsal process, which is true of this production as well. We started rehearsal on June 29th. Like I said, we are running kind of full day rehearsals, 9 o'clock to 4:30 every day. And so for us to take 14 days off, you know, our 2 weeks or the necessary month to kind of get everybody back and get everybody checked and make sure that we're all well to start up again, we wouldn't have had the time to do that.
Oh, back in December, you had a roof problem that closed the theater. You had to move your performances to other venues. What's the status of the season ahead for Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater?
Our season isn't quite put together. I can't say anything definitively, but I do know that we will take a step back this fall. Certainly, our window for this summer and making Hairspray happen was being able to have this outdoor venue. We really kind of felt strongly like that was the best place to do things and to gather. And we know that once the cold sets in this fall, again, that obviously outdoor is not an option for us. So I think this fall will end up being a lot more kind of virtual experiences or a very kind of small gathered experiences as well. We'll probably go a little harder in some of our special events this fall as we kind of wait for things to settle down. But we're hoping, like I think most other arts organizations, that in 2021 that we can kind of start to roll in productions a little more fully. So we know this fall will be a little lighter for us, and that's okay. We have plenty of things else going on at FMCT right now, so this will give us a good opportunity to maybe kind of put all of our energies in getting our building back online.
Aside from the roof problem, there is a proposal that's been brought back to expand the Island Park footprint for additional theater space, maybe a black box theater, some other production space at any rate. What's the status of that?
That is still a conversation that our organization is having with the park board. So that additional space, that additional land that we have requested is still not yet approved. But our first two phases of our construction project include certainly fixing the roof over the auditorium. So phase one is that fix and renovation of all of our production spaces. So that would include our dressing rooms and scene shop and costume shop area, in addition to the auditorium. So phase one is that piece, and then phase two would be our education wing and offices, all which would fit into our current footprint of land that we have at Island Park. And then phase three would be that addition where we would need some additional land to make that happen. And so we're able to move forward with the two most important phases, which are phase one and two, in the time being while we wait for that final answer from the park board.
Meanwhile, the threat to live performance and the complications it's made for FMCT has raised other issues, particularly with university theater programs. I'm thinking of one right across the river that you were connected to at one time.
Absolutely.
That's the MSU Moorhead Theater Program is a bit under threat as to whether it can sustain itself. What's the importance of theater programs like Moorhead State and Concordia and NDSU to the program at FMCT?
All of our arts organizations, at least in my opinion, in our town, we all do better when everybody else does better as well. And so taking the MSUM theater program out of the equation is really, it makes this really kind of solid community that we have, to use an analogy, like a Jenga tower, right? You take out that one peg, in this case, the MSUM theater program, and sure, that tower might stand, but it's weakened. And so there is a lot of sadness and remorse of the status of that program, and hopefully they'll be able to figure out something to maintain that program or change that program so it becomes a little more viable for the university. But for FMCT as well, is that we're really proud to be one of the first professional jobs that a lot of our local college artists have. In summer in particular, we hire a full staff of teaching artists or technicians. Most of those are coming from college programs in town, the three universities. On a personal level, it's sad. That was a training program that I certainly use every day in my professional life, both when I was teaching for 10 years in the West Fargo School District, and now as an artistic director, I lean upon those skills from that program. And so to see that resource go away for the next generation of artists and creators, that is troubling to me.
Adam Panko is the artistic director of the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater. Hairspray is on stage at the Plaza, the lights at Cheyenne, 3100 Cheyenne Street in West Fargo, Wednesday through Friday, curtain at 7:30, or the lights are on at that time. At any rate, you can get tickets at fmct.org. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate this opportunity to chat all things theater with you.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 29th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
Even as Dakota Territory prepped to divide into states in 1889, women's suffrage was a point of contention. Suffragists presented a petition at the Territorial Convention in January that was signed by over 4,000 women asking the legislature to enact a law giving women the same voting rights as men. A pro-suffrage representative, Mrs. Barker, spoke at the territorial session, noting, 4,000 Christian women of Dakota have sent up their prayers and petitions asking for the right of suffrage. There are women on this floor who do not want the right of suffrage, but if there is one who does want it, it should be extended to her. She does not want it for notoriety, nor for personal aggrandizement, but because she loves Dakota. Representative John Cook from Jamestown stated, "There is no reason, aside from traditional prejudice, why the right of suffrage should not be extended to women." Suffrage was not enacted at this session, but next up was the Constitutional Convention, which convened in Bismarck on July 4th that year. The men held many discussions about who could vote, debating how long someone had to be a resident to vote, and whether foreign-born residents could vote before becoming citizens. Delegate John Carlin said, "It will be seen that every description of civilized male humanity has been given the right to vote." Though it garnered great discussion, women's suffrage ultimately would not be offered in North Dakota's new constitution. It was even debated whether or not the legislature should be given the power to let women vote. Some argued that they should not be granted this, since they could not then repeal the right. Eventually, it was established that women's suffrage could be extended by the legislature, but could not pass unless approved by a majority in a general election. John W. Scott of Valley City unsuccessfully proposed the simple solution of striking the word male from the rules about voting, stating that suffrage was of far greater importance than prohibition. Mr. Carlin noted, "It is not necessary in the advocacy of this question for any delegate to champion the right of woman's suffrage. It is sufficient for him to know that he is doing justice to every citizen, whether male or female. If you are here to frame a constitution for one half, you should say so and not say you are acting for the people." This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Utility companies have been prevented from cutting off electricity during the pandemic, but those rules are expiring.
We're worried about, you know, having a disconnection in the middle of the summer, in the middle of a pandemic.
Without federal help, some families could be left in the dark. The safety net disappears on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, you may know that we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, event promoter Jade Nielsen of Jade Presents discusses the impact the pandemic is having on the music industry, event centers, and the people whose livelihoods depend on all of that. Tom Eason will deliver a Plains Folk essay. Tom Brousseau will talk about episode 4 of his Great American Folk Show. And Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.